Hi, this is Dr. Glenn Livingston, and I have a treat for you today. There is a gentleman who I've been following for some time. I learned about him through Terry Dean. He's got a very engaging is not quite the word, it's captivating style of writing copy and keeping you coming back for more. I've been following him on his blog for months now, and I eagerly await him coming out with his next audio. And I said to myself, well, wait a minute, Glenn, you're perfectly capable of asking him to do an audio yourself. So I'd like you to welcome Ben Settle. How are you, Ben?
I am doing good, Glenn. And just again, I do want to thank you for doing this. I really appreciate being here. I've been a fan of yours for a long time, too.
Well, thanks. I was hoping that we could talk today more about copywriting specifically on blogs, because your blog is so captivating. Maybe we could start with you just telling me, how do you use your blog? Like, how did you start blogging, and what are you trying to accomplish with it?
It's kind of weird. I don't consider myself a blogger more than an email marketer, because basically every time I send an email out, which is pretty much every weekday, the next step is that I'll put it on my blog, and we can go over reasons why I might do this later. But first and foremost, I always think of it as email first, and then I put it on the blog, because later on the blog, you can do things that you can't necessarily do in an email, but first and foremost, it definitely starts as an email. Yeah, the blog also has its benefits and everything, but I always start with email.
You're really from a more traditional direct response paradigm then. You've got a list, and you're talking to your list, and you're making offers to your list, and giving value to your list.
And this is just my philosophy on this, and people are more than welcome to disagree with me on this, but I see it more as sort of like takeout versus delivery. With email, you're putting yourself right in front of someone's face, assuming it gets through and everything, because they're checking their emails every day. People aren't necessarily going to check a blog every day. I mean, they might intend to, but things happen, things come up, we run out of time, whatever. But email, you're delivering it right to their front doorstep. And people, at least in my experience, are much more likely to read an email, and if I'm selling something, you know, responding to that offer, than they will from a blog.
Email is what they use to communicate with grandma, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you had to get your message to somebody and you had their email address, chances are you would send them an email and not put it on a blog and then send them an email to them saying to go to your blog.
Right.
It was mission critical.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So first and foremost, when you're thinking about writing to your list, you're thinking about writing an email. Then why use a blog at all? What's the purpose of the blog for you?
Well, because there's a lot of people who, no matter what we do and no matter how much value we give, or just maybe they just don't like getting on lists, and I certainly don't blame anybody at this point, but some people just won't get on your list, and they're more comfortable maybe reading your message through a blog reader, through something like FeedBurner, or something where they're 100% sure they're not going to get spammed because they're in complete control of how it's delivered. So there's a lot of people who do that too. So to me, it's almost like the sequel to email is the blog. I mean, I start with the email, but I already know it's only a certain amount of people are going to get that email. So now I can nab the rest of them, or a good portion of the rest of them, right on the blog. And then I also use some other social media sites to point people to that blog, because I can't point them to an email. So it kind of serves as a nice backup to email, so to speak.
I find that I actually get a better conversion, or if you boil it down to dollars per email sent, I'll find that my numbers are actually better if I send them to the blog first.
Yeah, and you know, that's not that unusual. When people test this, it can go either way. A lot of it comes down to what are people comfortable with. If you have a list that's just comfortable and they're used to you sending them to a blog, or I don't know, it could just be a safety and comfort thing, but I've found the exact opposite usually.
It also could be that, now that you say that, you're a much better copywriter than I am, and it might be that you're more skilled at creating trust and believability in the email itself, whereas I rely on my audios and on the blog, people are making comments and there's a lot of social proof, and that seems to create the trust and believability. It could be a factor of your copywriting ability. I guess regardless, the advice we give to the listener would be that you need to test which works best for you.
Oh, definitely, because it could be the exact opposite of what we think it's going to be. And I don't know about you, but I find that to be the case more often than not. So I'm a big fan of testing all these things.
Yeah, I always think that I'm brilliant, and then I find out once again that I'm not. And maybe some of these questions are not quite as appropriate, but if you were just to quickly compare and contrast how you write for an email versus how you're going to write for a long-form sales letter, are they dramatically different?
Well, that's a good question. The writing part, the actual copy, is, at least for me, it's the same in everything. But the strategy is always way different. I can give you some examples. If I'm on my blog, which started out as an email anyway, it's very, very personal. I mean, I'm going to say things that I probably wouldn't say in a regular sales letter for fear of either confusing people. You know, there's a whole bunch of reasons why I wouldn't do this. But in a long-form sales letter, you may have colder people reading it, and they're not quite onto your jokes and, you know, way of speaking and colloquialisms and all that sort of thing. But in an email or in blog, I just use those two words interchangeably. I'll just say blog, but I also mean email.
Okay.
I just let my hair down. I'll purposely misspell words sometimes because it gets in people's psychology. It's very hard to ignore when you purposely every now and then misspell a word or maybe use a word or a phrase that's not really widely used, that it's ingrained in people's minds because of popular culture or whatever. Yeah, I'll do things like that, but the actual writing, the technique of writing to me is the same with everything. It's all about structuring information in a way where people believe it and trust you and, you know, you lead to that response mechanism, whatever that's going to be. That's all the same, but the strategy is always different because obviously if you're sending a postcard out or writing a squeeze page, you don't have necessarily as much room. We're on a squeeze page, for example, just I'm a partner in a golf business and I do all the copywriting for it. Not long ago, we had a bunch of Google ads, I guess, were turned off on us by Google because we were using the same squeeze page over multiple different domains. So I had to go through and start changing these squeeze pages. And the first one I sent to him, the guy who's kind of in charge of this whole thing, he's kind of the marketing mastermind guy, he's like, all it was basically a video and a real quick call to action, and there was very little copy. For whatever reason, I thought that would be a good way to go. And he's like, no, his understanding and from what he's been seeing in his test, Google wants you to give content, and you got to at least put something up there that's valuable in and of itself, even though it's a squeeze page. So I basically just wrote the life story of the golf guru whose stuff we're selling. And I didn't take a long time to do it, but it was copywriting. And it was just leading up to them opting in. But it was sort of like a semi-long-form sales letter in a sense. I mean, it wasn't nearly as long as a regular sales letter. But the same principles apply to that as far as the technique of writing, as if I was writing an email or a postcard or a direct mail letter or whatever. It really is just the strategy that changes, but the technique and the methodology is always the same.
The other thing that I heard loud and clear was that on the email or the blog that you're much more familiar, that you'll let your hair down and you'll tell some jokes and you typically won't use humor in a sales letter because people don't know you yet.
Yeah, I learned a lot about email from a guy named Matt Fury. So a lot of when I talk about email, I mean, I have to give credit where credit's due. I learned a lot from observing what he does and from a couple courses he took and all that. But I always liked his take on it. It's talk radio. You're talking to your audience. They're tuning in every single day to hear from you, and they're expecting a certain style from you. They just have certain expectations. And whatever those expectations are, whatever you've laid down, is sort of a grounding for that. But you're talking to them like they're tuning into you, and it's a complete. It may not even be really a sales letter. I rarely ever do any hard selling in my emails. I just use my daily emails to basically build up the sales, other sales letters, and I'll kind of tease people over. But there's always something in it that's worth listening to, at least in my mind, whether they click on a link or not.
Sure.
But in a sales letter, it's flat. I mean, you're selling. You know, there's none of this playing around having fun necessarily. I mean, I still have fun when I write long-form sales letters. And just having a fun sales letter that's fun to read while also selling, I think it's something worth testing. I recently wrote an ad like this for a self-defense client of mine, and he told me it pulled like gangbusters. And, you know, I had people in my mastermind groups were reading it, and I kept getting comments like they were laughing out loud, but, man, they really wanted this product. And I wasn't making jokes, but it was just kind of had entertainment value to it. I could give URL to that if you want. But
sure.
Okay, it's lawdogtactics.com.
Lawdogtactics.com.
I don't make any money off anyone going there. To me, it's just an example of where I've started doing this more and more in a sales letter. Of course, in this case, again, this is sort of a back-end sale usually for this client. So these people who read it technically probably know him a little better than, you know, but it's not like email, it's intimate.
I'm just looking at your headline. How even skinny Barty Fife cops single-handedly control and dominate violent criminals, gangbangers, and other cold-blooded killers without even drawing their guns.
You know, there's a little bit of a humorous element to it, but it's serious at the same time. I'm not trying to just tell jokes or anything, but it makes it easier and more fun to read.
That's and the benefit doesn't get lost in the humor. I think that the type of copy where humor is dangerous is when the humor becomes the point of the copy and people don't walk away with the benefit. Bob Bly told me, he said, well, when you go to buy from a salesperson, do you want that salesperson to entertain you or do you want that salesperson to tell you what you need to know so you can make a decision? I thought that's well taken, but you know what? I wouldn't mind if the salesperson entertained me at the same time, as long as I got the information that I needed to get me motivated to purchase or, you know, to make the decision not to purchase. I think that's a point well taken.
I believe that a lot of this comes down to infotainment, because we live in a society now that really doesn't give experts all that much respect. But, you know, if you're a celebrity, you're an entertainer, you can go out and write a book on a serious scientific subject and they'll take you seriously because you're on Oprah. But you could be a real expert and get ignored. So I think people kind of like it. There's this actor. You remember that TV show MASH?
Sure.
Okay, the actor Alan Alda, I think he played Hawkeye on that show. He was recently on this TV segment for 60 Minutes. And because the founder of 60 Minutes recently passed away, I don't know exactly when he did, but I guess they were good friends. And he basically described 60 Minutes that way. He described it like, and I just thought this is brilliant the way he described it. He said it was a hot dog that nourishes you like broccoli. So it looks like really this fun, great-tasting thing, but it will nourish you kind of like something you normally wouldn't want to eat or even look at. And you kind of mix those two together. And to me, I don't go in thinking, oh, I'm going to write this joke or that. To me, it's more like telling stories and just saying things in a way that people have a hard time not listening to. They may not buy, but, you know, at least they're going to read this thing.
You're going to give them a broccoli hot dog.
Well, you don't actually taste the broccoli in it. It looks like a hot dog.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So you're kind of giving him stuff that would normally be maybe dry and boring, but you just made it look fun. You kind of wrapped it up in this fun pill.
It's a vitamin-infused hot dog.
Yeah, it really is. And when it's done right, it works really, really well, because think of how much content is out there on the Internet right now, especially. I mean, there's just content everywhere. It's not hard to get content. I mean, it's almost like everybody's trying to out-content each other, which is fine. I mean, content is good, in my opinion. But it starts to get to the point where now everybody's delivering it, so how can you deliver it differently? In my opinion, it's to make it fun to consume, funner than everybody else's to consume, and you'll stand out, in my opinion at least, far and above everyone else.
I love that. And personally, it's one of my problems, because I like to play in the deep end of the pool. I do. I like to play in the deep end of the pool. And to me, if you look at all of my work, I'm always trying to be original. I'm always trying to contribute something that no one else has contributed. And I've invented a lot of formulas. And I'm like this mad scientist professor sitting in my AdWords lab trying to crack the code. And I looked at Terry Dean one day and I said, Terry, I just realized you haven't invented a damn thing. He hasn't. He's just really, really good at very straightforwardly teaching people what they need to know to succeed, you know, with the basics, getting them together, getting them started. And I said, you know what, Terry, if I did a lot more of that and if I did it in a more fun way, even though I wouldn't be contributing, I think it's part of how they inculcated me in school. So you get in a PhD is all about making a unique contribution. But screw that. It's time to have some fun. And I know these things as well as anybody else does, so why not stop playing in the deep end of the pool all the time?
Yeah, and the good news is that you can still be original and say things that no one else is saying by having fun. I mean, just by using your own personal experience. Like, you just said something really neat. You said something like, I'm the Google AdWords guy in my little lab in the back room. That's a fun analogy. I mean, you could probably play up on that like crazy, and it's just fun. I'm like the black sheep uncle in the family reunion that, you know, sitting on my rocking chair just telling stories, you know, and having fun. And, yeah, no one else likes me, but, you know, all the kids like coming over to me and listening to my stories. And that's kind of how a good marketer is.
Let's talk about that. You consistently find meaningful inspiration for, I was focusing on your blog posts because I'm more familiar with them, but how do you manage to infuse fun into your marketing? Where do you find that inspiration on a consistent basis?
I'll just get little ideas, kind of like you just kind of spat out that image. That'll happen to me throughout a given day a couple times, and I just write that stuff down. And then when it comes time to sit there and think of an email or blog post to write, I'll just infuse it with something I want to say. I think this is kind of probably where I veer off the path a little bit, and some people might think this isn't a very good idea, but I'm finding it works pretty well. Is I don't hard teach in my emails or blogs at all. I used to do it all the time. I used to hard teach because I thought, well, I got to hard teach and get out there and do all that. But now what I do is I have fun first, and then I lead it into some kind of inspirational. I want to inspire people, or I just want to make them kind of amused, maybe laugh and smile. Again, I may not do this in a sales letter necessarily, but on a blog post, I'll do this all day long. And there'll be a lesson in it. It'll be valuable. But compared to what I'm selling, it's nothing. I mean, it makes people kind of want more. And I think that's kind of that fine line that everybody walks. Is, am I giving away too much or not? And I just say, as long as you're having fun, people are going to read you no matter what you say. I mean, you could be telling the same lesson over and over, but if you do it in a kind of an entertaining, fun way, people are going to listen to you. I mean, and why wouldn't they? People are so bored out of their minds. They're getting all this content. Okay, how do I know who to listen to and read today? I've got 10 audios and 5 videos and 8 PDF reports in my inbox. How do I choose the one I want? I think the one that's the most fun to go through is going to be the one that gets picked every time.
I have to agree with you. Could we talk about some of the entertaining, fun blog posts that you've put up? I've got 5 or 6 of them here today, and maybe you could tell me the story behind them and, you know, how people are reacting. Would you mind?
That's fine with me.
Okay. Emails abducted by aliens and Bigfoot. How did that come about, and what was that post all about?
Well, I had actually been gone for a couple weeks. I'd taken a road trip with my wife to go see my dad, and then we went to Roswell, New Mexico. This was for the 4th of July, which UFO enthusiasts will recognize that as the anniversary of when the UFO crash happened in Roswell, New Mexico, back in the late 40s. We went there, went to the UFO festival, had a fun time. We live in Oregon, so we drove down to Tucson, over to Roswell, and then kind of circled around and went up through California to this town called Willow Creek, which is only about 160 miles, I think, from where I live. It's a Bigfoot town. It's a town where, I mean, all I can describe it is that everyone is obsessed with Bigfoot there, kind of like everyone's obsessed with aliens in Roswell. So I came home, and I told the story of, okay, we went to Roswell and to Alien Festival, and then we went over to the Willow Creek for the Bigfoot stuff. And I tied it into basically a story about how when you have your own business, and especially an internet marketing business, you can go take 2 weeks and do that. It doesn't hurt your income or anything, and in some cases it might have even gone up. That was sort of the story I told. It's kind of an inspiring story. I didn't teach anybody anything, but people seemed to love it. And then the reason I said emails abducted is because my emails, I stopped writing emails for a couple weeks, and it was because I went down to Roswell, Mexico, where the aliens were, and it just kind of fits, you know?
The interesting thing that I hear in the way that you're telling that story is that you're on the lookout for fun experiences in your daily life. You're on the lookout for times when you feel inspired and joyful, and then you're thinking, how could I bring that back to my list?
I mean, I never really consciously thought about it that way, but it's always about sharing an experience. And it may not always be something that makes someone feel good. It could be a frustration, too, although I don't do very many of those types of things. But people can often identify with, when you talk about things that happen in your life, no matter how ordinary they are, a lot of people can identify with those things.
For example, you had an email subject called Phantom Pooping Prospects.
This is a perfect example. Might bore someone who doesn't have a dog, but for people who do, they'll probably identify with this. I have a dog who is pretty stubborn, and I live out in Oregon, so during the winter it rains quite a bit here. And a lot of times I don't like standing out there in the rain, waiting for my dog to do her number two there. But she likes to kind of sniff around, and she'll sniff around for a half hour. She'll actually get in the position like she's going to go, and then not go, and then start sniffing around again. And I just kind of joked my wife once, I just called her, it's kind of like a phantom poop, you know, she's sort of like going but she's not, and it's very frustrating because she's purposely keeping us out there, she's a very smart dog, and she knows that she can get away with it. So I tied that into a sales lesson. I thought, well, you know, there's a lot of cases where it's not even, at least in my experience, I like to sell to people who are already 90% sold. So I thought, well, I could tie that into that, just kind of like a dog sniffs around looking for the right spot before they go. All of us as consumers, and myself included, will often sort of sniff around, ask different people different questions, whatever we're buying, until we actually pull the trigger and buy. So we're all kind of like phantom pooping prospects, you know. And you can save yourself a lot of time and energy just by focusing on people ready to buy instead of trying to wait for them to sniff around and then getting frustrated by it.
Qualify your prospect.
But remember, that would have been the broccoli. I gave him a hot dog.
That's the most unique way I've ever heard that lesson told. Another one, Ben, and this is the one that I actually said, okay, I've got to get in contact with this guy. Disturbing things I do on the phone.
Yes, I believe that was the email that I
heard. I mean, how could you not click on that email? Disturbing things I do on the phone. Your email box is inundated with, you know, 3 days left and
yeah, exactly.
Just trust me on this.
Yeah.
50% off.
That's all people are capable of right now, you know?
Right. And then in the middle of all that, it's like, disturbing things I do on the phone. What? What the heck?
And not only that, and some people look at this and they say, aren't you kind of flirting with being kind of raunchy or something? And the answer is yes. I have no desire to gross anyone out or even talk about raunchy things. But people being who we are, we all have a little Beavis and Butthead in us, I believe. Just judging by the popularity of certain TV shows, which you can learn a lot about through popular culture like that. Yeah, they're getting inundated with 3 days left. I mean, basically they're copying the latest Frank Kern subject line, which works for one or two people, and after that it doesn't work, and it gets ignored. And they're copying and swiping all these really great email writers like him, and then they're wondering why nobody's opening it. Well, if you can just be unique and talk about something that is personal to you, and that is kind of interesting, and yeah, you have to at least take a look at it. Like in that case, I was talking about how when I'm on the phone, like you and I are right now, I sometimes hold a 9mm handgun. It's not loaded, and I made a little joke about that, and then people kind of got freaked out at me. I said, you know, I usually take the magazine out, and a couple people actually thought I was serious about that. But, or I'll have a golf club. I'm learning how to golf now that I'm doing this golf info publishing thing. I'll have, like, my 7-iron out, or I'll have maybe my putter, and I'll just kind of hit a golf ball into a cup. I'm not doing any of that now for whatever reason. I'm just not. But my point is it's something unique. I didn't teach anybody anything in it other than that when you move your hands and you're doing something with your hands, you activate the creative part of your brain, or so I've been told. And I found that to be the case in many cases. I'm inspiring people, but I'm not really teaching anything.
Was it Gary Halbert that said that people will pay for a change in emotional state? Is that the guy that said that?
You know, he did say something like that, because I remember in his book, The Boron Letters, he was writing those letters to his son while he was in federal prison, which is actually a very interesting book for anyone who hasn't read it. He said something about how people will often make buying decisions when they're at a very strong emotional point in their life. Like, for example, if someone just recently got pregnant, they're more susceptible to offers that are relevant to helping them get through whatever they're going through, which makes a lot of sense, actually.
But I think that the other aspect of it is that if you think about what people go through, particularly now in this economy with the level of frustration in the world and at work, most people are overworked and underpaid, and sitting on their computer for many, many people is a largely frustrating experience where problems are coming at them one after the next in their email. And then when they get something with a subject line that says, you know, phantom pooping prospects or disturbing things I do on the phone, it immediately just gives them a chuckle and it changes their emotional state. It's an oasis in the middle of the desert or a port in the storm or some other analogy. I found that to be true. I found that some of my more successful promotions will link to something funny or a picture of me or one of my best ever talked about how my psychotic dog got a hold of my discount codes. There's a crazy picture of him on the site, and I think the subject line was, help my psychotic dog. The takeaway I get here is think about what's personal to you. What was it that changed your emotional state, and how can you transfer that enthusiasm into your marketing? I've heard selling described as a transfer of enthusiasm, and I think this is that in action. I mean, I can put some more of your subject lines up where people can go over to bensettle.com and subscribe to your blog and take a look. It's definitely worth reading. I wanted to jump back for a second and ask you about this. One of the things that I find is that because I also market in a talk radio show model where I'm trying to connect with people every day with some type of valuable content and message that they're going to look forward to that day, you can't do what you would do in a sales letter every day. Before I write a sales letter, I research the market for 100 hours or so. Then I take 100 or 200 hours to obsess about that sales letter, and I get feedback from 5 different people, and I edit and I re-edit and I read it out loud, and I talk to consumers and I go back and forth, and, you know, people look at the GlennSentMe.com letter. That letter is responsible for more hours of my life than I could have possibly imagined a single letter could have ever been. But, you know, a sales letter, it's really kind of a misnomer. It's really a business starter. What I'm asking is, how do you balance the fact that that's what it takes to write an A-plus letter, right? That's what it takes to really get something that can build a whole business, at least it does for me, with, well, I really have to take care of this business and nurture it and grow it as strong as it can. I need to water it every day. And sometimes I don't have more than a half an hour to get something out to my list. So how do you strike that balance, and how do you get all the valuable content into those daily doses when the process of copywriting is such an exhaustive, long process, unless it's not for you?
To me, the blog and the emails are the main focus for me is just to get them to that sales letter that I labored over. And if I can get, the more often somebody sees my sales letter because they were intrigued or, you know, teased over there by something that's relevant to their problems in their life, the more chances I have of making a sale. So to answer your question, your other question at least is, yeah, by writing every day, and I try to basically send something 5 days a week, you will be amazed. Like anybody listening to this, if writing is just a really hard thing, just try this. Just for 30 days, 1 month, write every day. And it doesn't have to be long. It could be 100 words. It really doesn't matter. But write something to your list every day with a link to whatever you're selling, but kind of just talk to them, you know, just as if they were in front of you. You're not constantly pitching your best friend. But what would you say to them, to your friend, if they had a problem that your product solves? And just try it. Trust me, you will become a much faster writer, and it gets much easier. And your brain will just start getting used to looking for normal things that happen to you throughout the day. And you'll start mixing and matching these things in your mind without even realizing it. I really couldn't describe it any differently than that, because you just kind of have to experience it. But it works. I mean, your brain is, as you would know, I mean, you would know this way better than I would, that it's just, it's one of these things that when you kind of start telling it to do something, it will.
I think that's great what you're saying. And the thing that most people don't realize, if I jump in as a psychologist for a second, is that the mind is never blank. It's never, never blank. Even when you're sleeping, they've done these studies where they wake people up at all different phases of sleep, and people always have something that they're thinking. And so the experience of having writer's block is actually the experience of actively inhibiting what you're thinking from coming to the surface. So what you're recommending for people is really wonderful, because you're taking the pressure off and encouraging them to let it flow more easily and to be less judgmental about what they're thinking about. And the other thing I like about it is sometimes I will have a group of people in a room and they're talking to me about having writer's block and not knowing what to say in their blog or their emails. And I'll say, well, how many of you are parents? And usually 2/3 of them are, because we're a bunch of old farts. And then I'll say, well, how many of you can't think of something to tell your kid every day? And all their hands go down, because everybody can think of something to tell their kid. And I say, well, why don't you just think of your market like your child? You would protect your child. You would love your child. You want the best for your child. You'd want to be communicating and educating and helping them grow up every day. It's the same thing. You're just communicating with your market like it's your child. That breaks through some walls sometimes. But what I hear you say is that just write every day anyway, and also that you don't think of the job of the email as closing the sale. All you're trying to do is get them the next step of the way down the funnel.
It's very rare that I'll sell anything directly in an email, because if you do that one too many times, what if, for example, somebody's a Rush Limbaugh fan and they tuned into Rush Limbaugh and all he did was sell them for 3 hours? They would tune them off really quick. But we permit the little commercials, the profit center commercials, and you can basically do that with your email. I mean, you're giving some interesting information. Even if it's just something that you went through that day that you can kind of tie to whatever you're selling, believe me, nobody's going to get mad at you for saying, hey, and if you want to know more about this, or, you know, you want to know about solving this problem, and if they have that problem, they'll go to your link. I mean, a lot of people will, and some people will buy. And by getting in front of them every day, you know, maybe not 5 days a week when you're just starting. I mean, just start with, you know, 2 or 3 a week. But if you start getting in the habit of doing that, and eventually you'll start enjoying it. It's almost weird. It's like very therapeutic to just talk about the dumbest things that happened to you in your life. And you'll get people emailing you back, and, man, I know what you're talking about. Or you'll get invited on really cool talk shows like this. Things will start happening. In fact, I heard it this way. If you're positioning yourself as an expert out there in whatever you're doing, and you don't have something to say every day on that, well, how much of an expert are you? I mean,
right.
A real expert. I mean, you could probably give a psychology tip every day if you wanted to.
And especially with the blog, because when you put something up on the blog, people inevitably ask more questions. And there's always some other angle that you hadn't thought of and something that inspires you. And It really is just a matter of being willing to dive into the pool. Once you're in the pool, there are a lot of people there that are going to help you swim. And if you like your topic, you're going to want to swim every day. So, cool.
Not only that, but the more you write and talk to your market and have a dialogue with them, people start writing you back, giving you ideas or asking you questions. Well, that becomes fodder for your next day's blog post or email, you know?
Yeah.
And it's easier to write about because you're just answering their questions publicly.
Yeah. I sparked off a big controversy today. Got everybody disagreeing with me today in my blog. I'll talk about that a different time. How about audio? How do you use audio on your blog?
I think audio is a great way to sell. I used to have a lot more interviews up on my site, but I started packaging them into a specific products and everything, which tended to be, it just added value to some products, but I still keep some audios up there. If nothing else, even if you don't directly make a sale, like for example, I have a couple copywriting audios on my site where I just freely gave away really good information on copywriting. And even if someone doesn't buy from me, I'm demonstrating my credibility and my knowledge, and a lot of people are just looking to believe in something. And they may be more likely to buy something or hire you if you have a service just because they heard you on audio. They got to know you because they heard your voice and they hear the conviction in what you're saying. And again, it's that whole talk radio thing. You become sort of a mini celebrity. And it's funny because the person who taught me audio, his name is Michael Senoff. He basically said people will call him up because he does a whole bunch of audio. If anyone listening to this knows who he is, he just does a ton of audio. And people will call him up and, Michael, I can't believe I got a hold of you. You know, do you have time? Do you have 5 seconds? Just 5 seconds. And he told me, he goes, you know, half the time I don't have anything going on. You know?
Yeah, right.
And they think he does, you know, just because they're hearing him on audio and nobody else is on there.
Creates an image that's larger than life.
You know what? It really does, and it's great. I mean, it's a great sales tool. Now, as far as selling directly through audio, I think it just depends on what you're selling and who you're selling to. For example, I bought a very expensive, this was just last year, I bought a very expensive course just because of a teleseminar recording. I didn't even see the sales letter. I didn't see any emails. I just listened to this thing and I wanted it. And I've also been involved in projects where audio for, this is for high-end products, where just somebody would listen to an audio because it's like done in an informational, but you know, just like a talk show format. I mean, good information is being exchanged and trust is being built. And people have said, and this is for a course on how to buy and sell businesses that I actually did with Michael Senoff, who I just mentioned a few minutes ago. And people, he would get emails saying, you know, I listened to that audio you did 5-6 times, and I just had to buy it. Because people will burn these things, the CDs, or put them in their iPods. They'll take them with them on their walks while they're walking their dog or driving to work. And it can be really, really powerful.
And you know that I absolutely endorse that philosophy because I've got over 100 audios produced now for this particular list. The reason I started doing audio so intensively was I'm a psychologist, so I'm used to talking to people, and I found that whenever anybody would call me to ask me about the product, my close rate was 100% if they were qualified, if they should buy it. And I thought, well, that makes sense, you know, because I'm a trustworthy guy, and the product does what it says, and really, they just had to know that it was real and that it was for them. And I thought, well, how could I replicate that en masse? And that's when I started distributing the audio. But the other thing, which relates very much to copywriting, is that I think people will tend to swipe a letter or pieces of a letter as if that were the whole system. And they don't realize that there are many letters that you could never send cold traffic to. But in the context of, you know, several audios that have been played and a relationship that's been building, that letter makes a lot more sense to the prospect. And the more relationship building you do like that, who is going to take the time to reverse compile 100 hours of audio? Who's going to do that? They're not going to do it. They're going to swipe my letter. They're going to assume that it doesn't work because then they'll test it with cold traffic and they'll assume that it doesn't work. So including audio in the whole system, I think, is a competitive protection. It's, of course, a sales enhancer for the letter itself.
It's one of those things where if it's done right and you're talking about a problem that someone has, and I go back to that old adage, don't tell me about your weed killer, tell me about my crabgrass. You know? Let's say you're someone who sells weed killer. You could probably do an hour-long audio just on crabgrass, the kinds of crabgrass, how evil crabgrass is, and you know how it's ruined your life. And then stick a plug, well, you know, at the end and say something like, well, I have a solution to this, and if you'd like to check out my solution, you've just spent an hour bonding with someone about a big, gigantic emotional pain in their life. believe me, they are going to go check out your product because you actually took the time to get to know them and you understand them and they feel like they know you and they trust you and all that. And you cannot replicate that in a text sales letter, not from what I've seen at least.
Talking about the actual calls to action that you use in audio, how is that different than what you do in email to get people to click over to a letter? How do you move people from an audio to a sales environment?
I'll tell you, you have to really lay it on thick, the scarcity, and hopefully it's real scarcity. Some people might do fake scarcity, but real scarcity, you really have to light a fire under someone because they may not be in front of their computer when they're listening to your audio. So if you just come up with some really good ways, like scarcity and a really strong offer, something where they feel like they have no choice, they've got to write down that URL if they're not there. A lot of us will assume that they're sitting in front of their computer, but really they're not. Most people are driving through traffic or whatever. What can you say? And this is kind of a question that everyone has to ask themselves. What can you say to make it so that this person has no choice but to write down my URL? And just let your mind come up with as many possibilities as you can and work as many of those in as you can, because it's like they're ready to buy, but they're just not there in front of their computer to click a link, and unless you give a phone number and they have a cell phone or something, which would not be a bad idea to put, or an order line, which would not be a bad idea for audio. What can you say? What's the one thing that you know about your market, how they're going to respond to this? You know, are you going to give it to them for a dollar for 30 days to try out? Are you taking this thing off the market, you know, next Tuesday? Like I said, it's really different for everyone. There's no one size fits all, but you really got to put yourself in that mindset. And really, it always comes down to how well do you know your market. I mean, the better you know your market, the easier you can custom tailor a close for an audio or a sales letter or any other sales mechanism.
Essentially, you're saying to lay on the scarcity very thick in the audio because you have to get them off their butt to take an extra leap. Maybe I'm making a mistake then. I'd be curious about your opinion because I build all of my audios to be part of my ongoing systems. I will put this on my blog and I'll send people to the blog after we record this. But I will also, if people react well to it, and I'm sure they will, put it into my follow-up systems. I've decided to just have a very simple call to action at the end of the audios. If the audio was relevant to a particular sales letter, I'll send them to that sales letter at the very end. Very, very low key though. Like, thanks for your time and attention. If you'd like to find out more, please visit blank. And I'll repeat that in all the audios. And then I figure since most of the people are on my list anyway, that they're going to get another email and be visiting the blog soon, and sooner or later, those emotional deposits in their bank account will burst. Sooner or later, they will say, okay, I'll go to Glenn sent me and, you know, take a look now. I've got to see how to go to the next level. Do you think that's a mistake? Do you think that every audio should have some type of scarcity built in? Or how could you do that in an audio that's going to be part of a follow-up system so you don't know when the person's going to get it?
Yeah, that's a good question. When I was saying scarcity, I guess I had in mind, I was thinking of a live teleseminar in that case. But if it's something that's recorded, I'm going to give some advice that may not seem relevant, but I think it is. There's a guy we both know named Ken McCarthy, and he was once telling me, I interviewed him for a book I wrote, a copywriting book I wrote, actually. And I was interviewing him about order forms. He's a very, very intense student of direct marketing history. And he was telling me about this copywriter named Mel Martin, who in copywriting world, it's like geek for Elvis. That's like the Elvis of the copywriting world. You know, he's like the guy everybody refers to when it comes to writing bullet points. And he helped get started one of the biggest newsletter publishers in the world, Boardroom, just on a lot of it based on his copy. In fact, he was so good that the guy who runs Boardroom, or ran Boardroom at the time, wouldn't even give his name out. He wouldn't even tell anyone who Mel Martin was. I guess he had some kind of agreement. But here's my point. The guy was so good at writing order forms, too, that this is kind of how Ken described it to me, that you could take that order form without the sales letter and throw it out on the street, and if somebody picked it up who's at least in that market, they'd be very tempted to buy it because there'd be some offer or some reason, and, of course, the way he worded it and all that. But, you know, you have to believe there'd be some kind of offer, some kind of motivation. It's just one of those things that what would it take if somebody heard your audio and they're not even on your list? Let's say somebody burned it to a CD and it got flung out a plane window or something, and some guy that's never even heard of you before picked it up and listened to it, who's not even near the internet. And what would it take? What would you have to say in that close or throughout the audio? I mean, you can pepper these kind of calls to action throughout the audio, just like a TV infomercial, for example. what would you say that to make them, their first priority is to go find a computer or find a phone so they can order from you? That's sort of the mindset I go through. I, just me personally, I don't like to necessarily think that it's just only people in an email are going to see it and all that. I put myself in this mindset. What if someone who has no idea who I am, but has the problem that we're trying to solve, what would I have to say to that person to get them to find some way, almost frantically, like shaking, they have to find a phone or internet. What would I have to say to get them to go do that?
I love it. I see what you mean. I don't know what the answer is offhand, extemporaneously, but theoretically, I could have the equivalent of order form copy in my audios at the call to the action at the end.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be long. I mean, I know what you're saying. You want to kind of just, and it doesn't always have to be really high emotion either. I mean, you can still do it calmly because remember, it's that whole message to market match. You're the AdWords guy. So, I mean, you're obviously very good at getting these things in little spaces and getting people to react to very little small messages.
Sure.
Well, you can
sure.
do that with audio too. I mean, whatever psychology you're using to get people to click your ads, well, now just take it to the next step. How can you get them to want to order after they've heard your audio, of course?
Do you have a little more time, Ben? Could I have another 10 minutes or so, or do you need to go?
Glenn, we could talk for another 2 hours if you want. I mean, I've got time blocked out for this. I've been looking forward to this all weekend.
What's really interesting is I'm as big a fan of you as you are of me. So we both probably perceive each other as larger than life because we've been following each other's audios and blogs. So what I really wanted to talk about was emotional copywriting and particular how it might apply to AdWords. I was hoping to go beyond the theory and maybe just talk about, like, where do you get your inspiration for emotionally charged AdWords copy? I know you don't do a lot of AdWords, but if you needed to translate it to headlines, that'd be fine. Where do you get emotionally charged copy ideas besides your own personal experience? Is there anyplace else that you do that?
I'll start with this, that one of the emotions that I don't, and especially in AdWords, that I don't see a lot, and maybe that's because people are testing it and it's not working. I mean, I do write AdWords ads. I don't do nearly as many as probably anyone who regularly uses AdWords, but I can bang these things out fairly easily. But the one, a lot of people will talk about emotion. Well, do you want to, you know, maybe someone has a pain. I'll talk about that pain, you know, that emotion, whatever that is. But one emotion that I just don't see it a lot in AdWords, and when I've seen people doing it and I've asked them about it, they say, yeah, as a matter of fact, that ad is pulling pretty well. Usually it has to do because they're really honing in on that emotion of belief, and they're putting something in those ads to make people believe it. And I'm going to give you an example. I was talking to one of the guys I'm working with in this golf business last night, and I asked him, I said, you know, what are some of our highest pulling AdWords ads? Because I haven't been keeping up on it. And he sent me a few of them. And I noticed that a couple of them had the name of the golf person who created the product, who's a PGA Master Professional, which is only like a handful of them in the world. And in the golf world, that's pretty impressive. You know, that's kind of like the PhD of golf, you know. I mean, you can't get any higher than that. And I noticed that he put the guy's name in there, and some of those winning ads, his name was in there with his title, PGA Master Professional, that sort of thing. So I want to just start out with, I like to start at least testing that emotion of belief, and this definitely applies to anything, emails, blogs, whatever. That's a very real emotion, and yeah, it's not one of the popular ones, it's not one of the sexy ones like greed and all that, but it's a very powerful, because so many people are just looking for a reason to believe. I mean, they have so many options, and the person who gives them some reason to believe what their claims are often stands out head and shoulders from everybody else.
Yeah, and that goes right back to what we said about get them to feel like they're sitting in the living room with you if you really are a trustworthy person. And it was actually, I was talking to Jim Peek from My Success Gateway about another guy who runs a massive search engine optimization company, but they don't really serve clients. What they're doing is CPA right now. They're driving traffic to offers and just functioning as a massive affiliate. They have done so many tests because they've got millions and millions of visitors every single month, and they've done so many tests on headlines and colors and guarantees and offers, and they said that the single biggest factor which predicts conversion is trust. And if they don't trust you or they don't believe you, then it doesn't matter how good everything else is. So I'm glad you're going to talk to us a little bit more about how to create that in our headlines and in AdWords if we can.
One way to do it, besides just mentioning the person's name, you know, obviously AdWords is one of those things where you can target multiple different segments of a market. What constitutes belief and everything is going to be different probably depending on what the market. I mean, if I'm writing AdWords about Ben Settle, but no one's heard of me, it really doesn't help me very much to put my name in the AdWord. But using titles, using specifics, and when I mean titles, I mean like if someone's a PGA Master Professional, it doesn't matter what his name is. anyone in golf who's familiar with a PGA Master professional is going to be impressed by that. I mean, they're going to have to at least say, hey, well, this is different than, you know, hit the ball 70 yards farther every time. I mean, it just has a different ring to it. And I'm not saying this is always going to be the case. I mean, with AdWords, it's just constantly changing. But being specific, using very titles that are just that just ooze belief, I mean, those are two very powerful ways to do it. Do you want to talk about those comic book ones now? Or do you...
I do. I definitely do.
I just wanted to preface everything with the belief things. Right now I've got called in front of me, and are you going to basically give these to your list so they...
If that's okay with you, I will.
No, it's perfectly okay, because that way they can see kind of what I'm getting at here.
Very kind of you.
Okay. I have the one open that the title, the file name is Batman 385.
Okay, I got it.
I just picked that one randomly. I picked these three just because they look like they had good examples, and I've done this. As I'll often use these little direct response ads from comic books, and they're always older comic books, so you can't swipe them word for word. I mean, things have changed in the last 40 years. But basically, you can use these as great little guides, sort of templates, and or at least, if nothing else, idea starters. And, for example, you have this one ad, an Atlas body question in 7 days. And then you see this guy, like, flexing. From what I understand, that ad ran for years and years and years.
I think I was 11 years old when I saw that.
Yes. I mean, it just pulled and pulled. And, you know, Charles Atlas, very savvy. Whoever's doing his marketing is very savvy. But if you just kind of look at that headline, an Atlas body, yeah, his name was Charles Atlas, but I suspect his real name was something else. But everybody, when you hear the word Atlas, you think of that Greek god probably who holds the world up. So you instantly, just by the popular culture and everything else, an Atlas body makes sense. And then you notice he's got a question mark there. Well, that question diffuses any feeling of hype. There's absolutely no hype when you put a question mark in front of something, because you're just asking a question. You're making a claim subtly, but it's hidden behind like this question mark. And then in 7 days, kind of, I mean, I don't know how you'd exactly translate this to an AdWords ad, but my point is you can use something like this as a guide.
By the way, Ben, it sometimes works to have an extremely short AdWords ad where it makes the ad stand out and look different, and where everybody else is, you know, using every last inch of real estate in their, in their AdWords ad, when you come out with a very strong message, especially if it, you know, pulled so well in direct response over all those years, that's worth testing.
I want to take a small side trip here just because it seems relevant. I befriended this guy last year. I wrote an ad for a product he created on pay-per-click, and his name is Jim Yagi. And he's not one of these really well-known guys or anything, but he's one of the few people I've ever met that can actually make money on the front end using AdWords in the biz op market. I mean, he just really got this down. He's a computer scientist and all that. I guess he, like, built his first computer application. He's, like, 9 years old. So he just, you know, he's always been into systems and that sort of thing. And one of the things he taught me was contrast, like what you were just saying. He's, like, contrast. But he will look at all the ads, and he'll make his completely smaller or bigger depending on the ones around it. And it's almost like it stands out like it's a different color almost on the page. And
absolutely,
I use that
yes.
in emails ever since. I use that in emails, blogs, any other writing too. All my paragraphs are now contrasting, so it's easier to read. And I just never even thought of it until then.
It's the opposite of marketing incest. Marketing incest is when you copy what everybody else is doing, but you don't know if they're doing well or not.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And let's face it, the person who's not inbred is going to be the king of the inbreds.
You're right. We've taken that analogy entirely too far, but...
But you know what I mean.
I know what you mean, sure.
But going back to that ad, and then you continue reading this ad, and it just hones in on every little thing. Your friends will notice. I mean, that's huge, you know. That's almost for any market, your friends will notice. I mean, I think I even used this in one of the golf AdWords, you know. You're swinging, you'll hit it farther. Your friends will be in awe, you know. It's just one of those little psychological hot buttons. Big, useful muscles, gain weight if needed, lose pot belly. All these tiny little hot buttons, 2-3 words, all packed into a little ad like that. And I just think these make great little idea starters when doing AdWords, if nothing else. I'm not saying copy them word for word, but just the way they structure the words and put these little, tiny little claims in like that.
You've got a whole collection of these at home.
I do. In fact, a few years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, I went up into my mom's attic. I went over to her house, and I started flipping through my hundreds of comics, and I found all the older ones, because these types of ads, I don't believe, are in the newer ones. I haven't collected comics in about 10 years, but after 1990 or so, they just for some reason started going to image advertising. So comic books are just as dumb as the rest of the advertising world. But before that, they had these great little direct response ads, and they just get into people's psychology. I mean, they're selling the dumbest things to people that you would never want normally. And yet somehow you find yourself wanting these stupid sea monkeys and all these other things they're selling.
Hey, man, sea monkeys aren't stupid. I bought them when I was
a kid. Well, I did, too. So, or the X-ray vision. Now, you know they're not going to give you X-ray vision, but,
right.
You know, you got to try these glasses out, you know. Or real shark's teeth. I think that's one of the headlines on this page. And
yeah,
anyway,
yeah.
So I went through and I scanned a bunch of them, and they're in a disc with a copywriting book I sell. So just, you know, can I give that URL out, or is that?
Oh, sure you can. No, of course.
Okay. It's www.copywritinggrabbag.com. And that book comes with a CD, and I put, like, all these comic ads. I gave you three of them as an example, but I have about 30 more, I think, on that disc. And if you're writing AdWords, believe me, it's the easiest thing in the world to go through these and just get inspiration for ways of wording things and claims and all that.
Very quick way to make the money back on the product.
I would say so, if you're doing a lot of AdWords.
And my audience does, so we'll make sure we know where that URL is. The question I wanted to ask you was, did you notice a difference between DC and Marvel?
You mean in the ads?
In the ads, yeah.
I don't think I even found many DC ads. I never collected a lot of DC comic books.
You're a Marvel guy.
I was definitely a Marvel guy. So I have a few, but I don't think any of these three are actually. I think Batman and Captain America. So I guess Batman, yeah, I guess that was DC. So I'm pretty sure that they probably advertise in all the same ones. And the beauty of this is it goes beyond just AdWords. I find inspiration for any ad I'm writing on just by reading these little ads. I mean, they just got into your brain.
And the reason I asked was that Dan Kennedy once gave a big speech about how the characters in Marvel attracted a different audience because they were more complex and less perfect characters. They all had some mildly tragic flaw. Like Spider-Man had to learn to be moral with his power. He wasn't immediately moral like Superman was. And that was more involving. And the idea of this talk, I'm forgetting exactly who did it, was that it was arguing for the necessity of creating a real human character in the persona that you market from. Just one more reason to be yourself for circling back to the writing emails to your market every day. It's one more reason to really be yourself and be somewhat self-revealing as you go through because you can't help but have some tragic flaw and your market will want to know what's happening next with it. So
that's true. In fact, you just reminded me of something. I once read, it was a book actually, I think it was the biography of Stan Lee, the guy who created Spider-Man, created a lot of those Marvel comics actually, Hulk and Fantastic Four and just about everyone. And he actually said, he goes, you know, a lot of people would compliment him on, wow, you sure came up with all these really cool villains, you know, Sandman and Dr. Octopus, all these weird characters, you know, which is kind of impressive that one brain could come up with all these interesting things. But the reality was he was much more concerned with finding new problems to give Peter Parker to make him more real.
And interesting.
Yeah.
And I certainly have no shortage of problems.
Exactly.
You seem like a real person.
When you tell a story in your ad that's describing someone who's trying to overcome the same problem the market has, that'll do more, in my opinion at least, and this is just total opinion. I never, like, tested this against anything. I believe that'll do more for your trust and believability than citing all of any other type of proof element. You know, offer, guarantee, testimonials, you know, whatever. I mean, demonstration. I think those are all great, but I think telling a story that they just feel like they're part of, or they're almost like rooting for you to get through it while they're reading it. Take the ad I sent you a few minutes ago, the law dog tactics. I mean, it's about a cop. So he got stuck in a riot, you know, this, like, skinny cop. What did he do? People who in that market who were writing to, they loved that. I mean, that's what they wanted, adventure in their life. So they bond with it, like, immediately.
And that's particularly important for people who are new starting out because I'm frequently asked, how do you handle a situation where you don't have testimonials yet and you're not comfortable making an extraordinarily strong guarantee, which I think is kind of dumb, but a lot of people don't want to make a really strong guarantee. Well, here's your option. If you can get people engaged and involved with your story better than everybody else in the market, then maybe you can overcome the lack of proof.
I think it's a huge mistake to rely on testimonials anyway. I mean, not only are they pretty much about to be outlawed from what I understand, or at least where you can put your good ones in, but now you got to put some bad ones in or something. I don't remember the total story. if you know your market well enough and you get your message to market match down good enough, I mean, it's good to have testimonials, but if anything, they're probably the weakest form of proof these days because they're easily fabricated. They're almost like those Photoshop bank statements now. If it's easy to fabricate and easy to lie about, people have that built-in detector. I'm not saying not to use testimonials. I don't want anyone to get that feeling, but I can tell you this. The ad I was talking about, Law Dog Tactics, that's one of about six ads I've written for that client. Only one of them has testimonials in it. We just didn't even bother with the other ones because they already knew who he was and everything. If you know your market good enough and you get that message of market match down, to me, that's the number one most important thing. That'll do more for your proof and credibility than any, and testimonials are just a nice cherry on top.
If you learn how to build a trusting relationship, then why would you need so much proof in the first place?
Well, that's true. I mean, you think about it, it's like, yeah. You know, I mean, you are the testimonial in a sense.
Right. Well, this is really, it's really exciting for me. Was there anything I should have asked you that I didn't ask you?
No, I think we covered everything in your list here.
Ben, my man, thank you so much. This was great.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. I really appreciate you having me on.
Happy to do it again whenever you want to.
For more advanced email marketing training, sign up for the free daily tips at bensettle.com.